From the mind of M. Night Shyamalan comes a podcast that will engage in intelligent discourse, reasonable discussions, and general enlightenment across all topics, except twist, it's actually Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man with 23 personalities, but a bitch ain't one.
Mike DiCruccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. Yeah, I mean, that's just my life. I have to live with all that, Mike.
Yeah, 23 personalities. That's are you going to go through all those personalities throughout the episode today?
You have way more confidence in my improv ability than I do. So I'm not going to do that.
So no, not quite. You're not quite a McAvoy.
No.
You're a Stewart.
Sure.
Because James McAvoy also played Professor X.
Oh, my God. Wow.
I just took the joke from Deadpool and applied it to your life. Although, you know what, Patrick Stewart is probably pretty good at improv too. He's a very good actor. I would not put it past him. So you know what? You're not as good as either Patrick Stewart or James McAvoy, Mike. Let's move on.
Story of my life.
Sorry to rain on your parade so early in the episode. But if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week we are doing the new film from director M. Night Shyamalan. That movie is Split. Are you excited to talk about Split, Mike? You saw this movie seconds ago.
Seconds.
Literal seconds.
In the car on the way home recording this. That's not true. I'm home.
That would be exceedingly dangerous. Yeah. Although you could say that you did anything seconds ago. Seconds are just a unit of time. It
true.
Is several seconds ago. Several thousand seconds ago at this point, probably. But still.
Probably, yeah.
But
it's still technically correct.
Yeah, so this movie is like so fresh in your mind. You like just walked out of the theater, basically. So how?
Yeah.
I mean, what was like? Was it just you in the theater today, or was
it
crowd?
It was just me until the about midway through the trailers when one other person walked in.
Okay.
So we got to experience this together, seven rows apart.
It was a magical communal gathering of people who, for some reason, hadn't seen Split yet. This movie had this movie was a pretty big hit too. It got number one at the box office, and it's gotten a lot of buzz. And I've seen a lot of people that rushed out to the theater to go see this because they had heard about the twist ending.
Ooh.
Like everybody was talking about this on Twitter, and I think a lot of people rushed out to go see it so it wouldn't get spoiled for them. Amazingly, it did not get spoiled for you before you saw it, and it's been over a week since it came out, so that's impressive on your part.
Yeah, it was. It came close. Having seen now having seen the movie, thinking back on stuff that I read, skimmed past,
right,
saw some articles that I didn't read because I was just like, oh, whatever.
Right, you were just too ignorant at the time to know what it was spoiling.
Yeah, exactly. If I had paid any attention / had read the actual articles, I would have had the spoiled.
Yes.
So I managed to remain unsullied.
Well, good job, Mike. We're going to be talking about Split in just a little bit. Right now, let's get on to some film news. It's time for some film news here on Film Bookcast, and we begin, as always, with some Star Wars news, Mike. every minuscule bit of information about Star Wars that we can get, we'll probably cram into film news at some point, but this is actually a fairly big one. The title for Star Wars Episode 8 was announced last week. Mike, this is a big deal for some reason. It is a Star Wars bit. It has no – look, the title of a movie has no bearing on the actual quality of the movie, although actually for Split – I would argue it does. Anyway, Star Wars Episode 8, directed by Rian Johnson, coming out in December of this year, is going to be called Star Wars The Last Jedi.
Yeah, I'm in.
Yeah. What do you think the title means, Mike?
Oh, it could mean so many things. As I did see people pointing out on Twitter, Jedi could also be plural?
Yes. So there could be several Last Jedi.
Right.
It could just mean Luke. It could just mean Rey. Could mean Snoke. You know, who knows?
You know, it could be anything at this point.
Could be anything, you know. And you know what? You know, Mike, first we had Return of the Jedi, and now they're down to the last one.
Yeah.
The Jedi suck at this.
Some dark times ahead.
Yeah. But what's
in the past. I don't know how timelines work.
What's also interesting about this title announcement is that the traditional yellow Star Wars font is in red, implying dark times ahead for the Star Wars universe. So Very excited about Star Wars, obviously, and Rian Johnson, I assume, will knock it out of the park, as he usually does.
I'm a little nervous about the Snyderverse bleed over into the Star Wars universe with the red font and the Last Jedi. Who knows what dark shit's going to happen.
I suppose, but I think Star Wars has a much better handle on tone.
That's true.
You know, it's a good point. Like Rogue One was a lot darker than Force Awakens, but it still managed to be a very fun experience, I think. And I think this, in particular, The Last Jedi is going to be modeling itself a lot on The Empire Strikes Back, which is the darkest of the Star Wars movies, and also the best one. So, you know.
Who knows what could happen?
Who knows what could happen? We're still a little ways away from Star Wars The Last Jedi, so let's move on into the next thing for a movie that could have been coming out in 2018, but now I don't think it will be. Ben Affleck is no longer directing The Batman. Ben Affleck plays Batman currently. He played him in Batman for Superman. He did a cameo in Suicide Squad. I think he just wrapped filming on Justice League, which is coming out this year. And he signed on to direct a solo Batman movie called The Batman with Warner Brothers, and that was supposed to come out in either 2018, 2019. But if you noticed his interviews, like, he was doing a lot of press for his new movie, Live by Night, and in those interviews, people would always ask him about Batman and what's going on with The Batman and what's going on.
Right.
And you could see him kind of getting, like, a little more defensive as time went on and a little more worn down and trying to distance himself from Batman a little bit. He's like, you know, well, we don't really know what we're doing yet. You know, it depends on where the script's at. And, like, I don't want to do it if we don't have a good script and all that kind of stuff. So now he has stepped down as director of The Batman and says that he can't do both jobs, acting and directing, at once to the best of his ability with this project. Which, you know what, he did it with The Town in Argo, so I don't really see what the problem is here.
That's a very diplomatic way to say that I don't want to direct this.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, who knows? Who knows what if that spells disaster for the rest of, for DC movies post Justice League?
Everything DC does spells disaster for DC movies.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, it really seems like he's trying to distance himself from this pretty shitty cinematic universe that they've built up to this point. I actually realized as this came out, DC has now lost more directors than they've had movies released in this universe.
Shit. Yeah,
because they've had 3 movies so far, and in the time that they've been making these cinematic universe movies, they've had 4 directors sign into projects and then drop out. Michelle McLaren was supposed to direct Wonder Woman and then dropped out. Seth Graham Smith was supposed to do The Flash and then dropped out. Rick Famuyiwa was supposed to do The Flash and then dropped out. And now Ben Affleck was supposed to direct The Batman and now has dropped out. And it's interesting because I thought that Ben Affleck might be stuck directing The Batman. I like watching his interviews, I could see him like trying to kind of get away from it. But Live by Night came out and was like a commercial flop and it was not well received. And so I felt like he might need The Batman. He might need to direct something that was going to be a surefire hit, so that, you know, he can get the clout back with the studios, but he's not. He's still producing the movie, and I guess he's going to select the director.
Yeah. I think in his statement, he said in working with the studio, he's decided to leave and is helping find the new director.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that means.
But this is another huge blow for the DC universe, I would say.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're definitely getting Wonder Woman. That's coming out. We know that. Justice League is definitely coming out. And then Aquaman is almost definitely coming out. I'm pretty sure it's filming right now. So I think it definitely has to come out. After that, like, I feel like their entire schedule is up in the air. They announced a bunch of stuff a while back. I don't think we're ever going to see, like, that Cyborg movie they're promising, you know?
Oh, yeah, the movie everyone's clamoring for.
When I was thinking of DC movies, top of the list was Cyborg, man. That's the one I wanted to see. And also, they were talking about Shazam, right? Where the Rock was playing Black Adam. And actually, news just came out like last week or so that they also want to develop a Black Adam solo movie starring The Rock.
Of course they do.
Which naturally, because The Rock is still signed on for that franchise. So if you got The Rock, why not use him as much as you can?
Yeah,
but
so far, he's still an instant box office hit.
So far,
So why not make a movie with him in it?
Exactly. But otherwise, like, I feel like after those 3 movies, I think this universe is in such great flux. Like, we really have no idea what to expect. And I think for sure there will be a Batman movie at some point. because Batman is the character for DC, right? The profitable character. But they haven't made like a traditional sequel to Man of Steel yet, right? They just did a Batman vs Superman thing, and you know they've been talking about like Gotham City Sirens, right? The spinoff of Suicide Squad starring Harley Quinn. I feel like they have so many potential projects that are just not happening.
Yeah, I feel like they're, you know, this is the thing we always talk about with you know, Marvel, they and DC, they both have these like 70-year histories of comic book characters to mine, and somehow Marvel is able to pick all the ones that people want and make good movies.
Marvel's picking the ones that like people don't even realize they want and are making good movies out of them. You know, they're doing Guardians of the Galaxy. Like, nobody knew who the fuck they were a couple years ago, and suddenly they're like the biggest franchise in Hollywood.
Yeah, and somehow DC can't make a good Batman or Superman movie. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah, so it's a huge blow for the DC universe, and Ben Affleck will still be starring in the Batman. He just will not be directing it. Early contenders, I guess there's a short list that's kind of floating around on the internet right now. I guess DC, the front runner for the job right now is Matt Reeves, who is the director of Cloverfield. He also directed Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War for the Planet of the Apes, coming out this summer. And I love Matt Reeves. I think he's a great director. I would rather he stick with Planet of the Apes movies, because those are kick-ass.
Yeah, because those are great.
And I would rather him not get kind of sucked into the DC machine, which has been kind of churning out garbage for a couple years now. So, but we'll see what happens. We will see what happens with the Batman. But, Mike, let's talk about the Oscar nominations, which just came out a few weeks ago or last week. Mike, both of our number one movies of the year ended up getting nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars.
Yeah, the battle is on.
The battle is on, and I think we know who's going to win this one.
Yeah, definitely not me.
Yeah, so Arrival and La La Land are both nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. La La Land nominated for 14 Oscars, which is tied for the most Oscars of any nomination, and the most Oscar nominations of any movie ever, tied with All About Eve and Titanic. Pretty big showing for La La Land there. The other nominees in Best Picture are Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. So a lot of those are expected picks. You know, I expected La La Land to get in there. I expected Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight. I didn't realize Arrival had that much awards buzz going into it.
Yeah, who knew? But somehow Amy Adams got snubbed.
Right, from Meryl Streep.
Yeah. Of course.
Which is ridiculous. But are there any of Best Picture nominees that were surprising to you out of those nine right there?
I'm surprised by Hacksaw Ridge. And also Mel Gibson is nominated for Best Director, so I guess Hollywood's over his transgression.
Yeah, his racism and anti-Semitism.
So I guess like that's fine now.
Yeah, that's a little strange, but I guess they're welcoming him back into the fold. You know, so and I liked Hacksaw Ridge. I actually thought it was a pretty good movie, and you liked Hacksaw Ridge too. I would not nominate it for Best Picture of the Year, but it's solid.
There it is.
It's a solid movie, and I think it, like, I've seen it, and I get why it was nominated for an Oscar. I was actually kind of surprised by Hell or High Water.
That's true.
Which is a really good movie. I loved Hell or High Water, and that made your top 10 list, and almost made my top 10 list. But it just didn't seem like the kind of movie that gets nominated for Oscars. It was like a sleeper hit. It came out a few months ago. I felt like it was kind of under the radar. So that's pretty cool that it got nominated. And then Hidden Figures, that's a pretty sizable hit at box office right now. I kind of expected that to be a pretty big showing, and it did get a lot of stuff. But yeah, Mel Gibson as a director was a surprise. Meryl Streep getting nominated for the 20th time, which is ridiculous. That's insane. For Florence Foster Jenkins, no less.
I feel like she doesn't even need to make a movie and she'll get nominated.
Yeah. At the point where, like, she was nominated a couple years ago for Into the Woods, and I feel like at that point, they were like, okay, so Meryl Streep came out with a movie this year that knocks the Best Supporting Actress category down to 4 slots.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous.
It is insane. So that's very strange. And yeah, I think Amy Adams probably should have gotten something for Arrival in that category. But other cool surprises. The Lobster was nominated for Best Screenplay. Pretty neat. That's a pretty cool original concept and a cool screenplay. OJ Made in America was nominated for Best Documentary.
That answers the question, I guess.
I guess that answers the question. There's been a huge hullabaloo on the internet about whether OJ Made in America counts as a movie or a TV show, because it's about 7.5 hours long. And it was released on ESPN in installments. Like, it's like a 5-part miniseries.
Right.
But I guess they released it in theaters and played it all at once for a week as an Oscar qualifying run.
Right.
And so a lot of critics, when they were making their top 10 lists, had a lot of, there was a lot of debate going on about whether it should count as a movie or TV show. And it's being counted as a movie. It's being nominated for Best Documentary Feature at the Oscars.
That's insane.
Yeah. I do bet you, though, when the Emmys come around, it's going to be nominated at the Emmys, too.
Sure.
It'll just be nominated for all the things. It'll be nominated for a Grammy next year. We'll see what happens. The Tonys are coming to call him Colin and everything.
It's going
to
be the first non-person to win an EGOT.
Speaking of EGOT, Lin-Manuel Miranda has the chance to EGOT at the Oscars this year with the Moana soundtrack. Moana is nominated for Best Original Song, which the song that's nominated is How Far I'll Go, which is a good song. It's not the best song of Moana. The best song is You're Welcome. And I'm kind of upset that's not nominated because that would have given us the chance to see The Rock rapping live at the Oscars ceremony. That would have been incredible. So instead, they'll have they'll probably have the person who played Moana do it. But I know there's a pop version of the song, too, by some pop star. I'm blanking on who it is. So I don't know who's going to be performing the song there. But La La Land is also nominated for two songs there. Nothing for pop star. It's a bunch of
tragic.
Bunch of bullshit. also nothing for Sing Street or the Deadpool rap or any of the other great original songs of 2016. Actually, Deadpool got nothing. And there was a lot of talk going into this that Deadpool might walk away with like a Best Picture nomination.
If it was going to win anything, I think it would have, or been nominated for anything, it would have been one of those like weird technical Oscars.
I agree with that. And I'm glad that Deadpool was not nominated for Best Picture, but the thing is it was nominated for Golden Globe for the Best Picture comedy, and it was nominated for the Producers Guild Award for Best Picture. It got like, it was named as one of the 10 best movies of the year by the Producers Guild. And everybody was like, oh shit. Like
what?
Like, because that's, I guess the Producers Guild is generally speaking a pretty good indicator of what's going to be nominated at the Oscars.
Right.
But Deadpool did not make the cut. There were 9 movies nominated for Best Picture. 10 were eligible. So I guess the 10th movie just was not good enough.
Just couldn't handle it.
I'm guessing it was either Deadpool or Silence. Because those two things are comparable. Silence actually got, I think Silence got cinematography, and that's about it. Which is it deserves a cinematography nomination, but I was a little surprised by the lack of love for Silence. It's a really good movie. I would like it to have gotten a little more love. Kind of surprising to me, Kubo and the Two Strings was nominated for Best Visual Effects.
There you go.
Which is awesome. This is the first animated movie to be nominated in that category since The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
That is pretty nuts. I kind of hope it wins. I don't think it will. I think the Jungle Book has that category locked down. But you never know. Ex Machina won that category last year. So
that's true.
Who knows? And also, Suicide Squad and Passengers were nominated for Oscars, which is malarkey. Suicide Squad was nominated for Best Makeup.
Sure.
So it literally got a nomination for the person who wrote the word damaged on Jared Leto's forehead.
Oh my god!
If there was any category that I wish Deadpool had got a nomination in, like that's the one. That's
yeah.
And then Passengers is nominated for I think Best Original Score or something. But yeah, so those are the Oscar nominations. And I did want to bring up this one last thing, which is not as fun of a topic as we've been talking about over the past 20 minutes. Asghar Farhadi, who's the director of films like A Separation, which won the Best Foreign Language Oscar a few years ago, and that was the first Iranian film to ever win an Oscar, actually. That's a phenomenal movie, too. I highly recommend people check that out if they haven't seen it. He was nominated again this year for a Best Foreign Language Film for his new movie, The Salesman, but he is from Iran, and he cannot attend the Oscars this year due to the Nazis, due to Donald Trump's due to Donald Trump's ban on Muslims going into the country. And so this is put everything into turmoil. I mean, obviously he won a couple years ago. Obviously Trump's ban is bullshit, right?
It's not a thing we really need to discuss.
Yeah. It's another horrifying indicator that our country is devolving into fascism at an alarming rate. Usually I like to use this podcast to distract myself from the horrifying world around us.
But now it's entered our movies.
It has entered the movie news. It's everywhere. And Asghar Farhadi has said that even if the ban is lifted, he's not going to be attending the ceremony, and neither is the actress who's in the movie. And many people in Hollywood have voiced their support for Asghar Farhadi, and many, many people have voiced their disgust with Trump's ban as well. And there have been some calls to cancel the Oscars from some people.
Wow.
And I don't think that will happen.
Too many ratings dollars that they would lose.
Yeah, they would lose a lot of money there. But I think his absence is going to be very much felt during the ceremony. And I think it's going to be a very highly politicized Oscar ceremony sure this year. I mean, I didn't see any of the SAG Awards this past weekend, but I guess almost every speech at the SAG Awards was like in support of some kind of minority who's being downtrodden by Trump.
Right. I saw David Harbour.
Yeah, I saw the Stranger Things speech, mostly because it was memed because of Winona Ryder's reactions,
expressions,
which were amazing. Like they were. she went through every emotion in the span of 2 minutes.
It's pretty crazy, but it was a really powerful speech. It absolutely was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was a very good speech.
I feel like we're going to get a lot of that at the Oscars.
I think we're absolutely going to get a lot of that. So it's going to be a really interesting Oscar ceremony. It's going to be a really terrifying couple of years. But
right, buckle up, everybody.
Buckle up, buckaroos. Anyway, Asghar Farhadi, I wish he could be good. I wish he could be there. His movies are so good, and they are so humane, and so like I feel like they have such an understanding of humankind, and it's basically the antithesis of everything Donald Trump stands for. And you know, maybe if you just watch an Asghar Farhadi movie, his entire perspective would change. Who knows?
Yeah, broaden his horizons.
Yeah, but so that really sucks. We stand with Asghar Farhadi, I think, and Let's move off from the downer subject, Mike. Let's try to distract ourselves with the frivolous nature of this podcast and move on to our discussions. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
So today, it's a bit of a stretch for me this week.
he says every week.
Exactly. I've been recently really distracted with The Adventure Zone as a podcast I plugged a couple weeks ago.
Yes, I remember you talking about that.
I've had a lot of episodes to catch up on, and it's about D&D, so of course I'm going to spend all my free time listening to that.
Sure.
When I'm not listening to that, I've been reading Patrick Rothfuss's novels. Name of the Wind is the first one, and the second one's called Wise Man Fear.
Okay.
And they're fantasy stuff. It's kind of run-of-the-mill adventure fantasy things, and they're really awesome. They're tons of fun. Rothfuss writes in this beautiful lyrical style, and it's so between episodes of Adventure Zone, I've been reading these 1,000-page fantasy books.
Yeah.
So I haven't had a whole ton of time to watch and read and watch TV or movies.
Yeah.
So as a result, my discussion this week is Ratatouille. A 10-year-old movie came out in 2007.
Yeah, Pixar. Maybe you've heard of it.
Maybe you've heard of it, yeah. Directed by Brad Bird and Jan Pinkava. And it's I saw it for the first time, actually, last week.
Really?
So, yeah, somehow this movie escaped me in my Pixar. I don't know. I missed it.
Yeah.
What do I have to say? Everyone's seen Ratatouille.
It's delightful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so much fun. And in the world we're in now, see our last news story. It's fun to watch this movie where a chef and a rat, these two things diametrically opposed, are able to overcome their differences and work together and bring brightness into the world.
Yeah. I feel like I'm seeing that in so many of the things I watch now.
Right. Like,
just looking for any kind of glimmer of hope. But
right.
Yeah.
Try any way I can escape the Snyderverse, I want to.
Yeah. Well, maybe if enough Ben Afflecks drop out of their movies,
right,
we'll escape the Snyderverse.
Oh, man. What if Zack Snyder directs the Batman? No, I can't.
Oh, God. Can you imagine?
Why'd I even put that out in the world?
That's going to happen now that you said it. So Ratatouille, good stuff?
Yeah, it's tons of fun. It's silly. It's Pixar. Like, what could you not want from a mid-2000s Pixar movie?
Fair enough. So that's very cool. That is Ratatouille from 2007, directed by Brad Bird. And then I have a couple of things to talk about in my discussions today. The first one is a movie called Fences, which is nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. We just mentioned a little earlier. And this movie is directed by Denzel Washington. I think it's his directorial debut. And it stars Denzel Washington and also Viola Davis. And I enjoyed this movie. I think it has terrific performances. Denzel Washington is incredible in this movie. So is Viola Davis. And the dialogue, which I assume is lifted straight from the play that it's based on by August Wilson, is also incredible. The dialogue is just fantastic. And there are a lot of genuinely great scenes in this. I could not shake the feeling, though, that this is a story that would be better told as a stage play, as it was originally intended, rather than a movie. Just the way that the story is structured, it feels more conducive to being in a live theater environment. So while this movie is good, I don't really think it lives up to the full potential of its narrative. But you've read Fences, right? You've read the play?
Yeah, I have. I read it way back in freshman year of college in one of my English classes.
Okay.
That said, I don't remember a whole lot about it.
Okay.
I do remember it being really powerful, though. I just don't remember specific scenes or anything.
Okay, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff to like in Fences, and I think Denzel Washington and Viola Davis are both nominated for acting awards for the Oscar at the Oscars, and rightfully so because they are seriously incredible in this movie. Although weirdly, Viola Davis is nominated in supporting actress when she should really be in the lead category there. But whatever, Denzel Washington is in the lead. I don't know. It's just a weird thing to.
I did hear along those similar lines that. Dev Patel is nominated for
Lion, yes.
For Lion for lead or supporting?
He's in supporting.
But he's the lead?
I think he's the lead. I've not seen Lion, so I can't say for sure.
Just Oscar things.
Yeah, just weird Oscar things. I mean, they had we didn't really talk about this when we talked about the Oscars, but, you know, last year and the year before it, Oscars kind of got slammed for the lack of diversity.
Right.
You know, the Oscars so white hashtag was the thing. And I think this year there was a conscious effort to recognize more movies by minorities, people of color, which is good, especially in these trying times. And so we have movies like in the Best Picture category, you have Fences, you have Lion, which stars Dev Patel, and you have Moonlight as well, and Hidden Figures also, actually. And so in the acting categories, you've got Denzel Washington, and you've got Ruth Negga for Loving, and you've got Viola Davis for Fences, and you've got Octavia Spencer for Hidden Figures, and Mahershala Ali for Moonlight, who's going to win the award. There's not even a question that Mahershala Ali is winning that award.
Yeah.
And actually, he was in Luke Cage also. He was Cottonmouth.
Right.
Which I actually just finished Luke Cage. I didn't mention that before, but since this is our discussions, I might as
You're
well.
You're in discussions. Go ahead.
it's a free-form discussions. Anything goes. I thought Luke Cage was a pretty good show, which was really good for its first half. And then the second half was like borderline terrible for a few episodes. And then it kind of came back towards the end, I thought. There is... Literally, I think it's episodes 7, 8, and 9. All three of them end with the exact same cliffhanger in different scenarios. I don't know if you remember that. But they're,
don't think I do.
Every single one of them ends with Luke Cage possibly being dead.
Yes. Like, nope, I do remember that now, yeah.
And after the second time, I was like, that's weird, because that just happened in the last episode.
Yep.
So it's weird they did it again now. But they won't do it a third time. And then they did.
They're just madmen over there.
They're crazy, man. but yeah, so I mean, and I think basically the big problem is that the best character on the show exits the series about halfway through.
Yeah,
and I don't think the show ever really recovers from that. But it does, I think, come back a little bit, and it kind of ends on a strong note. I think, although there is some weird stuff there's some laughable stuff. I think throughout the last half of the season, especially
it goes straight to bonkers comic book town.
Yeah, like, and there's a lot of good stuff there. I liked some of the bonkers comic book town stuff. But then there's like just really dumb stuff. Like there's the setup for Rosario Dawson starring in Iron Fist was hilarious. Where she
just takes it off the
she's like walking down the street and she sees a flyer for a martial arts place and she like takes the thing like, ooh, martial arts.
Yep.
I guess I'll go there now.
It's ridiculous. I kind of like that she's the connecting factor between all the series, but that one was pretty weak.
That was such a stretch. But sure, her introduction in the show was great. Like when she showed up off the bus and she like ran after this mugger and stole her purse and stuff. Like that was really cool. And like she had a lot of good stuff to do in this series. I just felt like there's a lot of good stuff in the show.
Yeah.
And there was moments where I like was really loving it and like really got it. And then like halfway through, I was like, okay, all the narrative steam has like just really, really let out of this thing. I really wish the Marvel shows were like 8 episodes a season.
Yes.
Like I think they would hugely benefit from that. The only one that I think never ran out of steam was Jessica Jones. And even then I've heard people say that one did run out of steam. I didn't feel it did, but I've seen people say that it did. So, you know, who am I to say that they're wrong? Except a podcaster. but yeah, I know The Defenders is going to be 8 episodes. So that's something to look forward to, at least. Anyway, yeah, so that's Luke Cage. Let's get off that for a minute. Let's talk about what I really want to talk about today, which is the XXX series. So, Mike, I don't know if you've seen the trailers for Return of Xander Cage. I believe you did, right?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So I saw the trailer for Return of Xander Cage. I had not seen the previous two XXX films, but I saw the trailer for Return of Xander Cage, and I thought to myself, that looks like the most insane thing I've ever seen. I need to watch the first two movies, and then I got to go see this.
I have to watch these.
So I watched the first two movies in anticipation for Return of Xander Cage. And I liked the first one. I thought it was fun. It's like an extreme sports take on James Bond. It's got a pretty dull and unoriginal story, but it has a lot of fun scenes and entertaining stunts, and Vin Diesel is so good. There's a scene in the original XXX where they're escaping like the villain's hideout, and there's a henchman who's about to escape like away from them, and Vin Diesel sees him and sees that he's smoking a cigarette, and so what he does is he says, "Hey, hand me that heat-seeking missile." And he shoots it, and the missile goes all over the place. Like, it's, like, swerving around the entire complex until it finally reaches the guy who's smoking the cigarette and hits the guy, and he blows up. And then Vin Diesel says, "I told him cigarettes were going to kill him one day."
And that's the kind of movie you want to see.
That's the kind of movie I want all movies to be. And so... So I was pretty satisfied with the first XXX. The second XXX, XXX State of the Union, is not good. And it spends half of its runtime basically apologizing that Vin Diesel's not there.
Right.
Because they kill him off in between movies. For the first half hour of this movie, like, every character, like, every 5 minutes is like, "Yeah, the original XXX died. Sorry. That's why we got you, Ice Cube."
Yep. That's why you're here.
Yeah, so Ice Cube is the star of that movie. That movie has some of the worst CGI I've ever seen. It's actually directed by Lee Tamahori, who directed Die Another Day, one of the worst James Bond films.
Yeah, it's all tracks.
Yeah, so he went from directing one of the worst James Bond films to directing one of the worst ripoffs of a James Bond film. The only thing that movie has going for it is Willem Dafoe, who plays the villain of that movie. And he's doing a very fun kind of, like, you know, he's basically doing Green Goblin again, right. Although a little toned down, which is, you know, I would rather just watch him in Spider-Man than in this.
Yeah.
So why did I want to see the third one, Mike, after I... You know, enjoyed the first one, hated the second one.
Right.
Because the trailer looked absolutely gloriously insane.
Yeah. You wanted to recapture the first one.
Yeah, but I wanted it to do it on a grander scale. You know, the first one is something that I had a lot of fun with, but I recognized it wasn't good. You know, it was but it was something that I enjoyed, and there's a lot of stuff to like in that, but I wouldn't call it a good movie. The trailer for the third movie, The Return of Xander Cage, which brings Vin Diesel back into the fold despite him dying between movies in one and two. The trailer for this made it look insane and crazy. And, like, you know, you're watching that trailer and you're seeing Vin Diesel skiing in the forest and you're seeing him riding a motorcycle on the water. And I'm telling you, man, the movie delivers on that insanity. When I saw the trailer, I had assumed that the motorcycle on the water thing would be the climax of the movie. Like, it just looked like that's going to be the big action set piece that ends the film. That happens 30 minutes into the movie.
What? No.
Yeah.
I don't believe it.
It does. And then it somehow gets more insane from there, Mike. This feels like a throwback to, like, the huge bombastic action movies of the 90s,
right,
in the best way. This is, you know, The Rock and Face Off and all those Nicolas Cage movies that we talked about.
It's the We Made It My Trilogy
condensed into one movie.
Wow.
And it is the best of the XXX movies by a mile. I think Vin Diesel learned a lot of lessons from the success of the Fast and the Furious franchise. And so the action is a lot stronger, and he surrounded himself with a terrific multicultural cast. So you've got people like Ruby Rose, Rory McCann, who is the Hound on Game of Thrones,
right.
Nina Dobrev, Tony Jaa, Bollywood actress Deepika Padukone making her Hollywood debut, and Donnie fucking Yen. All kicking some major ass throughout this movie, especially Donnie Yen. He has his opening fight scene. He, like, infiltrates this building and, like, just annihilates everyone. It's, you know, I was so excited to see him in Rogue One, and, like, he kicked a lot.
Yeah.
He did a lot of really cool stuff in Rogue One. But this is the true distillation of Donnie Yen, like the true, like, ass kicking martial arts Donnie Yen. And so I truly feel like we are in, like, a golden age of, like, totally insane action movies. That was my main thought coming out of XXX. You know, we've got the likes of, like, Fury Road, the Fast and the Furious movies, John Wick, the Mission Impossibles. Kingsman, yeah, absolutely. They are all delivering the over-the-top craziness that I so desperately crave. And you know, Return of Xander Cage might not be as good as most of the ones that I just listed. I do think it's well worth checking out. You know, some of the action, especially at first, is a little bit cut up, like it's ended very, like,
right,
a lot. But the choreography is so strong that it, like, breaks through that almost.
Yeah.
And just the way it progresses and progresses into insanity overload. And it's, like, there's so much, like, it's such a vanity project for Vin Diesel too.
Yeah.
You watch it and you're like, every girl in that movie wants to fuck Vin Diesel. and like every guy in that movie is always commenting on how strong Vin Diesel looks.
Yep.
But like the action really sells it, and like the action is so much fun to watch. There's, you know, there's a scene in this movie, I'll say, early on in the movie, Vin Diesel has a thing, like Vin Diesel has an exchange with Ruby Rose where he does where he holds up three fingers and he says read between the lines, implying that he's like giving her the finger. And then later on in the movie, Ruby Rose, who's like an expert sniper, Vin Diesel has this guy cornered in a building. Right?
Right.
Or no, the guy has Vin Diesel cornered in a building, I should say. And she's trying to like look through the building using heat vision, but it's like the guy thought of that ahead of time. And so the temperature has risen in the building and she can't use the heat vision because everything looks the same. So Vin Diesel has his hands behind his head, backs up against the window, and has his fingers has three fingers up as he's holding his hand up while he's getting the guy to keep talking. And the girl, and Ruby Rose sees him, and she says to herself, read between the lines. And then he removes his middle finger, so it's just the two fingers, and she shoots the bullet in between his two fingers directly into the other guy's head. And it's amazing.
That's the best thing of all time.
And that is one of the several nutty and insane things that XXX Return of Xander Cage has to offer. I highly recommend checking it out if you love insane action movies. It is a blast and a half.
There you go.
Yeah. Also, there's a terrific meta joke about the Avengers with Samuel L. Jackson, which I won't spoil, but
it's wonderful.
It is pretty great. Anyway, that about wraps up for our discussions, Mike. So how about we move on to our featured review of Split, starting right now.
What are we doing here? What the hell is going on?
I was sent to get you for a reason.
There's a flower on the pillows, a flower in the bathroom, like we're important.
The only chance we have is if all three of us go crazy on this guy.
Who is that? Maybe she can help us.
We're here! Help us!
We're here!
Don't worry. He's not allowed to touch you. He knows what you're here for. He listens.
All right, and now it is time for our feature review of Split, the new movie written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. This movie stars James McAvoy, Anya Taylor-Joy, Betty Buckley, Haley Lou Richardson, and Jessica Sula. The IMDb plot synopsis for Split reads, three girls are kidnapped by a man with a diagnosed 23 distinct personalities and must try and escape before the apparent emergence of a frightful new 24th. That's actually a great IMDb plot synopsis.
That is. Good job, IMDb.
That's really good. And I got to tell you, so way back in 2015, we reviewed a little movie called The Visit, Mike. And that was a found footage horror comedy directed by one M. Night Shyamalan. We were but children then, Mike. We hadn't even been doing our podcast for a year at that point.
Wow.
And now we've done it for two.
And infamously, the only time we've ever disagreed.
This is true. But also, I was actually listening to that review earlier today because I had nothing else to do. And so I was like, oh, let's listen to The Visit to prepare for our Split review. And that was the first time that we ever noted the super vague IMDb plot synopsis.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, my God.
Because I think for that movie, it said something like two kids go to their grandparents' house and, you know, things happen.
Right.
Basically. Yeah. But anyway, The Visit was Shyamalan's first foray into low-budget filmmaking since he hit it big with The Sixth Sense all those years ago. And so that's kind of why we reviewed it. And you can go back and listen to that review if you want, since we discussed his career pretty in-depth in that one. But for those unfamiliar, Shyamalan was a joke, right? Like, he was out on his luck, right? This is a guy who hit so big so early. The Sixth Sense, you know, cultural phenomenon. We still reference I See Dead People to this day.
Yeah.
Right? But that is a cultural phenomenon. Unbreakable, also a pretty big hit. Signs, pretty big hit. Well regarded, too. They were all critically acclaimed, well-respected hits. These movies were like events. And then the hits stopped being so well regarded, right?
Yeah.
And then they stopped being hits. It was like a slow descent, you know, that like after The Signs was The Village, which was followed by Lady in the Water, which was followed by The Happening, which was followed by The Last Airbender, which was followed by After Earth. You know, I tell a story in that episode in which I describe seeing the trailer for the movie Devil, which is the movie that he wrote but didn't direct, in a packed movie theater. And the entire theater just started laughing in unison when the words from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan came up. So he was not in a good place career-wise a few years ago. But The Visit ended up being a pretty solid hit. It got pretty good reviews, and it did well at the box office. I liked it quite a bit. Mike, you were a little more hesitant to embrace that film. But I was listening to our Visit review, and in that episode we talked about whether that movie was the comeback that we were looking for Shyamalan. And we kind of came to the conclusion that it wasn't. It wasn't quite the comeback, but right. It was a solid movie that might allow him to make his comeback in the near future. And you know what, man? The near future of 2017 may be a garbage fire in the real world. But the Shyamalan comeback is real, man.
Yes, I agree.
The man is on top of the film world again. Split is a real hit. Like it's like the success of this movie is enormous. It's getting a lot of critical acclaim, and so far, it has made over $100 million on a budget of $9 million.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
That is insane, and it just came out last weekend.
Yeah.
You know, so and now Split follows basically the same formula as The Visit. Except on a grander scale. So it's another low-budget horror movie. The Visit was produced for, I think, $5 million. This is $9 million. But it's not found footage. This is a more traditional kind of horror film. And you've also got a star power performance in this movie. You know, in that movie, in The Visit, there wasn't really any big-name actress. The biggest name was Catherine Hahn. Right. Remember, she was like, and she only had like a pretty small role in that movie. This time, you got James McAvoy in the lead role, who maybe isn't the most bankable actor, but... You know, he's somebody the audiences recognize. Like, he's a known face. Yeah. You know, he's the guy who's the lead actor in several X-Men movies. So he's like a
pretty... Right. He's pretty famous.
He's a pretty famous dude. I don't know about his bankability outside of, like, a franchise work. But, like, Split, I thought this movie was a solid horror thriller for most of its runtime. I enjoyed Split quite a bit. And McAvoy is incredible in this movie, I think. Like, he is essentially playing several different roles throughout this movie. Like, it is... unreal how good he is in this movie, actually. Like, I think that powers the movie basically throughout, I would say.
Yeah, his commitment to doing all of the different personalities and roles. Side note, I do love that the credits have him, he's credited for all 23 personalities, which is hilarious.
Yes.
But yeah, his willingness and commitment to do that and go that, like, have different voices and postures and 23 different roles, I don't think we see all 23 of them, but
I think we see a few of them a lot. Like, we see like six or seven of them quite frequently. And then I think we see like
in the journals.
Yeah. We see like bits and pieces of the other, personalities as the movie kind of goes on. But yeah, you see like the main three you spend time with are, Hedwig, the kid.
Yeah.
The woman,
Miss Patricia.
You just saw the movie seconds ago, so
yeah. Then we see Barry and Dennis. They're the most common four.
Right. And so yeah, but he's like, imagine being an actor and just seeing the kind of script, like seeing the kind of role that this is. Like, this is like the role of a lifetime, you know.
Yeah.
This is like the role that you choose to prove yourself as an actor, almost. Like, show off all of the range that you have. This is the role you take. Apparently Joaquin Phoenix was originally cast in this movie. As that character, which also would have been insane. I don't know how that would have turned out.
I think that's a much different movie.
It probably is. But I gotta say, James McAvoy does a great job. He's very menacing, but he's also very funny throughout the movie. And like, he has like a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And, you know, he's playing several different roles throughout. So it's a really incredible performance. It's like the performance of his life right here. And also, Anya Taylor-Joy from The Witch is basically the protagonist of this movie. And I think she's pretty good, too. I don't think she's as good as she is in The Witch.
No,
only because I feel like The Witch asked so much more of her.
Yeah, that, you know? I definitely agree. This is her role in Split is a much more traditional
horror kind of role,
horror woman, last girl role. Even though she's much more capable, I've noticed that recently too. In the more recent horror movies we've reviewed, the last girl is not just like the person that got lucky anymore.
Right. There's been a much more concentrated effort in a lot of recent horror movies to make that person. Somebody who's very capable of surviving this kind of situation. So, like, you got 10 Cloverfield Lane, for example, is a big one there. And also, Year Next, I remember thinking that. Did you ever see Year Next?
I haven't seen that.
Dude,
no.
Go see Year Next. Stop. we're pausing the podcast right now. Go watch Year Next and come back in an hour and a half.
It'll be my discussion next time.
Okay.
At least this time I thought of it beforehand.
Yeah. And there's stuff in this movie that I don't think quite works. Like let me rephrase that. There's stuff in this movie that I don't think quite works until the very end of the movie, and then everything kind of snaps into place for me.
Sure.
But for example, Anya Taylor-Joy's the flashbacks to her childhood. There was a long period of time where I was like, "Where are they going with this? Like, why are we seeing these flashbacks?" And like, you're seeing some traumatizing events, certainly, and like, you're kind of getting a little more backstory for a character, but it also seemed kind of inconsequential to what was going on in the movie for a while, up until the very end. And then I feel like the table kind of turns You know, Shyamalan is known for his twist, right? That's like,
what a twist!
What a twist! but yeah, the ending of this movie, and I'm going to save what that ending is for spoilers, essentially recontextualizes everything you had seen up to that point, I think. And it basically changes the entire movie. And I'd argue this may be Shyamalan's finest twist in a career that is built on twists. I think that's really interesting. Now, you didn't think it recontextualized everything for you. You thought it was just kind of like...
I guess we might have to save that for spoilers because... Sure. For me, without giving it, the twist just was like, okay. but we'll have to discuss that further in spoilers because it doesn't make sense to say that without talking about what the twist was.
Yeah.
My initial reaction coming out of this is that I didn't feel very tense or scared or like it was a traditional horror film.
Okay.
In some ways, that might be because the recontextualization doesn't work for me. It may make more sense if I knew if that landed. I was really interested in the kind of outer story of the psychiatrist and like that, her trying to figure out the mystery of what's going on with the girls and stuff.
So that's what you were more invested in.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. It's actually the opposite. I was like, I felt like we spent way too much time with the psychiatrist.
It is a lot of time. Yeah.
I was more into like what, throughout most of the movie, I was kind of more into what the girls were doing and like how they were going to escape this thing. And then, the stuff with the psychiatrist, I thought was interesting. And it was definitely, I think, worthwhile for what the movie ends up being at the end. But, as the movie was going on, like I said, some of the stuff didn't work for me until the end of the movie and it like recontextualized everything. So, stuff that seemed, what were you saying?
I was going to say, I think we may need to just get into spoilers because dancing around this is hard.
Yeah, I think we have to get into spoilers very soon. But I will say, stuff that seemed silly or I wasn't quite sure about the movie, what was going on, ended up a lot more on board with after it ended. I don't think you fully understand this movie until that very last scene. That's like the thing that kind of clicks everything in place. The only thing I will say about it before we get into spoilers is that it hinges on you having outside information from what the movie gives you. And if you don't have that information, which I don't think you did, I doubt it would make much sense. That said, I had the information and it was fucking awesome.
Yeah, this is my that fully says what I feel about this movie.
Yeah,
I was just like, yeah, this happened, I guess.
Yeah, I was watching.
Go ahead.
I was watching in the theater and I had a pretty packed theater. And when that happens, when that outside information that you need to have came into play, about 90% of my theater was kind of like looking around like what just happened.
Yeah.
But about 10% of my theater, myself included, was freaking the fuck out, man. So that it was a really, I thought a really fantastic way for this movie to go. And I gotta say, Shyamalan never lost his touch as a visual stylist, I think. And even when his movies were lousy, there is a lot to like in the way everything's paced and edited and lit. There is some goofy stuff thrown in that I think mostly works as comic relief. Mostly this is with McAvoy's Hedwig personality.
Yeah.
This is the bit where he's dancing in his room listening to Kanye West, which is that obsession with white boy rap is back from The Visit.
Of course, it is.
Which is very strange. I do think we spend too much time with the therapist and too much more time in the flashbacks. Conceptually, I think this movie is similar to 10 Cloverfield Lane, as we mentioned before.
Yes.
But with the addition of multiple personalities. And I will say, I think 10 Cloverfield Lane has a much tighter focus on what it's trying to be. So Split has like, you might say Split is split into different storylines or something. Right.
You wouldn't be wrong. I do agree though that this visually there's a lot of really cool, interesting things going on. A lot of like grabbing the camera and talking to it.
Yes,
which is interesting. I don't know. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff happening in Split. But yeah, so should we get into spoilers, Mike? For for Split. All right, let's do that. Let's get into spoilers for Split, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Split starting right now, Mike. I'm here to talk to you about the Unbreakable Initiative.
Yes, tell me. Okay, so here's the thing.
Yeah, okay, here you go. Oh, I thought you were going to say something. All right,
the outside information that I'm so desperately lacking, give to me.
Okay, so this is the M. Night Shyamalan twist for the Marvel era of storytelling, basically, I think. Yeah. Right,
yes,
so twist, Split takes place in the same universe as Unbreakable, Arguably Shyamalan's best film, and one that he's discussed making a sequel to for years. I mean, he has been talking about a sequel to Unbreakable pretty much since Unbreakable came out. But the thing about that, here's the thing about Unbreakable. Do you want to know the thing about Unbreakable, Mike?
Tell me the thing about Unbreakable, Mike.
Here's the thing about Unbreakable. Unbreakable, as you watch it, if you're watching it for the first time, you're basically watching this kind of very quiet, meditative adult drama. And only towards the end do you start to realize that this is a superhero origin story. And right. It's kind of like the big reveal that, like, it's a superhero movie almost. And it's not like a traditional superhero movie. It's still very much like a quiet, meditative movie. But it is a superhero origin story. And that's kind of like the big reveal to that end. That is essentially the twist. Well, the twist is that in that movie is that Samuel L. Jackson was responsible for creating Bruce Willis's unbreakable skin. Samuel Jackson plays Mr. Glass, who's got very breakable skin. That's like the yin and yang dichotomy there going on. What he's talked about doing a sequel to Unbreakable for years, but you wouldn't be able to recapture that same feeling again of like that gradual feeling of like, oh, this is a superhero origin story. Like that's crazy. You wouldn't be able to recapture that. And you know, it would like inevitably it would be a traditional superhero movie almost, you know? So instead, and this is why I think it's the greatest twist, he's made a supervillain origin story.
Holy shit. that changes the whole movie.
Yeah, I don't think we've really seen that before. in anything. And, you know, this is a movie that is pretending to be one thing until the very last scene when it reveals that it was actually something else entirely. There's nothing to indicate that this is an Unbreakable movie until you realize that it is, and suddenly you can pick up things throughout the movie that link it back to Unbreakable. And if you've seen Unbreakable, that helps.
right. So that's the information I was lacking. I have not seen Unbreakable. I do know that it is that, like, I knew all those things, that it's turns out it's like the superhero movie and it does whatever, all these things. So when it reveals that in Split that, you know, it's the Unbreakable almost sequel. It's the movie that will start the next movie is the comeback for Shyamalan. It was just kind of like, all right, sure. Like they happen in the same universe, but I have none of the context. So this makes so much more sense now.
Yeah, no. So he, like the way this plays out too, I love the way this plays out. He sets the scene by playing a very familiar piece of music. It's music that I couldn't place quite, but I knew I recognized it. And it's the theme from Unbreakable. It is like the literal theme from that movie that he's playing, really? That he's playing over that diner scene. And as he pans around the diner, while customers are watching the news describing how McAvoy's character, who's now called the Horde, is still on the loose, a woman mentions a similar case featuring a guy in a wheelchair 15 years ago, which is Samuel Jackson's character in that movie. Yeah. And we pan past her, and Bruce Willis is sitting there. And when she asks what the guy's name was again, he says, Mr. Glass, and then it cuts to credits. Which is like, because that's... it was just such an incredible... Like watching that scene, like I guess you didn't know it was Unbreakable until Bruce Willis showed up, right? Like that would be,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Watching that scene, like I sort of recognized the music, and I was like, "This sounds really familiar." I figured it was just like some music that I had heard in something else, and sometimes movies reuse themes from other movies and all that kind of stuff. And then the movie goes, and she says like that guy in the wheelchair from 15 years ago, and then right before Bruce Willis showed up, I was like, "Oh shit." Is she talking about Unbreakable? And then Bruce Willis showed up, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a split second later. I went through a lot of emotions in that very short span of time. I think he should have gone even further and included more of his old characters in that diner scene. I think we should have panned past Bruce Willis, and you see Joaquin Phoenix in a tinfoil hat.
Yep.
Or like adult Haley Joel Osment looking suspiciously over at Bruce Willis.
Oh, wait, yeah, hold on. Okay, never mind. Don't worry about it.
Well, that's a different movie. The Sixth Sense is a different movie. It's different characters. So it's not...
Yeah, but it's the Shyamalan-verse.
I don't think they're all the same universe. I think it's just Unbreakable and Split.
Split.
Right. Unless you pan past further and Mark Wahlberg is talking to a plant or something. Or the rapping kid from The Visit shows up. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
So that's kind of what I wish happened, is they just kept going and you see all these characters and they all come together as the Shyamal Avengers or something.
Yeah.
But apparently what Shyamalan's saying is he wants his next movie to be a third film, which would star Bruce Willis and James McAvoy pitting them against each other. And I would be so down for that.
Yeah.
So I think this twist essentially changes the entire movie you had watched up to that point, which I think is really remarkable. It goes from a straight horror film or thriller horror film into a supervillain origin story. And that's something I don't think we've seen before. It would be like if you've watched a movie about a clown that goes through immense tragedy and goes insane. And then at the end of the movie, Batman shows up and it turns out a clown's with the Joker the whole time.
Yeah, you know? That's kind of what it is. Now you had mentioned that you, if having the information that this is the, you know, pseudo sequel to Unbreakable, there's stuff you can pick up from Unbreakable. And
yeah.
What are those things? Contextualize for me, Beck.
Yeah, like, so there's stuff like, you know, I sort of rolled my eyes and went with it when James McAvoy turned into the Beast, right? Like, that seemed like a very ludicrous thing. And I had already kind of given in, like, this movie is taking place in a very strange realm of fantasy. Like, there's no, like, even if you have these multiple personalities, there's no way this can happen. That's, you know, that's not a thing. Like,
you can't change your height.
Yeah. Or you can't become bulletproof. Like, you can't become a bulletproof monster with this 24th personality.
Okay. That's just, I went with, like, yeah, you can't become, like, taller than you are. I totally skipped over the part where he just gets shot and nothing happens.
Yeah. But I think it makes more sense when viewed through the lens of an Unbreakable sequel. You know, he even unlocks those powers in a train station, which is the same as Bruce Willis in that movie. He gets his powers on the train. And I think it's in the same train station, too. Both movies take place in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And so there's interesting, there's like interlocking stuff throughout the movie that I think is really interesting. And like, it's pretty much on its own. Like, it's a self-contained story that kind of just becomes an Unbreakable sequel once you see that last scene. And then it's like, oh, and so like it sets up another movie so perfectly. And like, I'm so excited to see what he has in store. Like, this is it, man. This is Shyamalan making like his true comeback, I think.
Yeah.
And so also, like, moving past the unbreakable revelation a little bit, as the Beast, you know, McAvoy kills both the other girls and the therapist.
Right.
And as a side note, the scene where Anya Taylor-Joy sees him feeding on the girls is gruesome.
Was not expecting that.
Yeah, really effective, too, I thought. But he spares Anya Taylor-Joy towards the end when he sees her scars from cutting herself, which is something we're also seeing for the first time. We hadn't seen that at all in the movie previously. And so his speech that the other girls were impure because they had never suffered, and he sees something of a kindred spirit in Taylor-Joy. You know, he is the Beast throughout this, and throughout the movie, the flashbacks show that she has a background in hunting. And so Anya Taylor-Joy is like the hunter. And so they're almost like, they almost have the same kind of relationship as Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson in Unbreakable, that kind of like yin and yang relationship. Like, they have to constantly be fighting each other. It's like polar opposites. So I think it's a really interesting note to end the movie on, that he spares her. And at first I felt like I was being robbed of some kind of catharsis end of movie ass kicking almost.
No, I definitely agree there.
You know, as more time passed, and with the Unbreakable revelation essentially telling you that the story isn't over, I found myself digging that a lot more. I found, like, you know, there's layers to this kind of Beast,
right,
like, persona.
Yeah, I did. That's why the payoff of the flashbacks of that moment of that we're shown that she knows how to handle weapons and or gun, at least, and she knows what she's doing, so that when it comes time to be the last girl, she can kick ass, and it's kind of awesome. And that moment did feel very weird when
it happened. Yes. When it first happened.
Well, the moment when we're shown the scars and the Beast decides to spare her. And I couldn't tell. It seemed like it was, I mean, you know, this is without the context of the Unbreakable stuff for me. It seemed like it was trying to say something along the line, like, you know, embrace your trauma, and it makes you a better person.
I mean, I think it's saying it makes you stronger.
Yeah, it makes you, quote unquote, real life, you know?
Right. Like, I mean, I don't think we're supposed to side with James McAvoy's character on this.
No. Yeah, no. He goes to very extreme, you know, what he's saying there. But in terms of what the movie is trying to say about having trauma and that it's normal and that and all these things. But that's without the added layers of the Unbreakable stuff. Because that's super – that makes this way more interesting than I thought this movie was.
Yeah. So there you go. Yeah, you should watch Unbreakable when you get a chance.
Yeah, it'll be my other discussion next time.
There you go, Unbreakable and You're Next. Actually, what's really interesting, too, this is outside the realm of the actual movie, but the poster for Split, so the poster for Unbreakable has this big crack in the middle of it.
Right.
And it's like...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, the poster for Unbreakable is like Bruce Willis, Samuel Jackson, it's like cracks down the middle, and there's like cracks like kind of going off to the side of the poster. This poster for Split also has a big crack in the middle of it, and the cracks line up with the poster for Unbreakable.
Wow.
And it's amazing that this switch was able to be kept under wraps for up until opening weekends. Like, and yeah. Amazing that you ended up seeing it unspoiled, even seeing it a week later. Because this screened at a festival like in September, like a while
really?
Back. Yeah. And I guess people were just so taken by the twist, they didn't want to spoil, like they didn't want to ruin the, like the storytelling experience for everyone else. And so, I think it's really incredible. And like, just that poster clue, I feel like somebody would put that together before the movie came out, you know?
Right.
Cause the internet is a tireless machine who, who finds that kind of stuff. So yeah, I really dug Split. I thought it was a pretty solid horror movie. Up until the Unbreakable twist, which I genuinely think is one of like my favorite movie going experiences ever. Like it's just so it was so bold, I thought, and so insane. And like obviously, like we've joked before about how everything's a shared universe now. Like we mentioned that I think earlier in this episode. But this feels like a true sequel to Unbreakable, but also like its own thing. Like it turns out to be a supervillain origin story, which like that's something that I don't think we'd seen before. I think Suicide Squad tried to do that. You know,
right? Yeah,
did not do well.
Failed pretty miserably at it.
Yeah, and so it gives you this. You've basically been given a whole movie with just Bruce Willis' character, and you've been given a whole movie with just James McAvoy's character. And so pitting those two against each other will, I think, up the stakes dramatically in Unbreakable 3 or Split 2 or whatever it's whatever. Split.
Yeah, I think. Split. I think that is actually makes the scene when we are when the psychiatrist or therapist is speaking at the conference via Skype. That's as we're so
right. And actually, a lot of her speech, like this guy has powers that we don't know about. That's a lot of that is straight from Samuel Jackson's character in Unbreakable too.
Right. I was gonna say that's where she's talking about. Is this the where we unlock the supernatural and all these things? It makes a lot more sense in the context of what's going on here.
Yeah. So if you hadn't seen the movie, I hope you didn't listen to any of the spoilers thing because. I really dug it. So Mike, I mean, you came away from that kind of going like, okay, like.
Yeah, I came out pretty lukewarm just because it didn't scare me or thrill me in the same way that a lot of other typical horror movies I would want. Okay. Which is what I thought, what I thought this was going for, 99% of its runtime.
Yeah.
but at the same time, it's still fun, interesting. I think that it's still, a mystery of that there's an interesting mystery about McAvoy's characters.
Right.
That is engaging enough to keep me interested. But now with the context of the Unbreakable stuff that I knew I was going to have to watch it after coming out of this. It's a much more engaging, interesting thing that Shyamalan did. Also, his cameo in this.
Oh, yeah. It's great.
It's bizarre. I don't get why we need a treatise on Hooters, but we get it.
It's a good restaurant, you guys. I'm telling you.
Yeah, it's super weird.
Yeah. I miss seeing it. I didn't realize how much I missed seeing Shyamalan appear in his own movies. I used to hate it.
Was he in The Visit? I don't think so.
I don't think he was. And I don't think he appeared in Last Airbender or After Earth either. But I remember in Signs, I make fun of that performance so much because he's like the guy who is responsible for everything.
Right.
He's the guy who drives the car that kills Mel Gibson's wife in that movie. Yep. And so I always think it's hilarious that he casts himself as the guy who is the reason for everything that happens. Because he's also the writer and director, and he's the reason why everything that happens in the movie. I think that's why he did it. Like that's why he cast himself in that role. It's a metatextual thing. And then there's like scenes of them like seeing Shyamalan like from a distance, and it's like these almost like majestic shots of Shyamalan. He plays like a pretty significant supporting role in that movie, actually. I think he does the same in Lady in the Water too. He also plays a pretty significant supporting role. Which I don't think I've seen Lady in the Water, actually. If I have, it's been a very long time. Yeah. So, once again, it sounds like I'm a lot more positive about a Shyamalan movie than than you are.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, I'm not coming down negative on this one. I'm just coming down uninformed.
Right. Well, it's also... I mean, I think that's also a fair criticism of the movie. It's, it's giving you something that's... if you haven't seen Unbreakable, like...
It does. The twist doesn't do anything.
It doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I always say that like something should make sense within the concept, within the confines of the movie. And so if you haven't seen Unbreakable and that twist happens at the end. I think that doesn't make a ton of sense. I do think it makes sense in the context of the movie, like knowing what's going on in Unbreakable. Yeah. But at the same time, I think the movie works on its own without the Unbreakable stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, like I said, I'm not coming down negative on this one, but definitely there is no twist for me. Or there was no twist because right. it didn't do anything. It was just like, oh, look, Bruce Willis, get it. Like, I get that this is Unbreakable stuff, but like, I didn't know what any of it meant. So it didn't change the movie.
Fair enough.
So that's my biggest criticism.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed Split. Mike thought it was pretty solid.
Yeah, solid. Not pretty. It's just solid.
Solid. All right. Yeah, so I really enjoy Split. I highly recommend people checking it out. I'm telling you, Shyamalan's back. This is like...
Yeah, I would not be surprised when the next Unbreakable movie happens that it's back, like he's in.
Yeah, I never thought we'd get to this point. I genuinely thought Shyamalan was in the gutter forever. Like,
yeah, but and it's also the thing we've talked about, too, specifically with Cloverfield and those things, where these kind of low-budget... Annapurna and Blumhouse movies.
Yeah. This is a Blumhouse, yeah.
Yeah, are these vehicles for people to make awesome and do cool things.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was part of his problem is that he had ballooned into these gargantuan blockbuster budgets, and he was failing every time. And, you know, he did The Last Airbender, he did After Earth, and both of those bombed, and so he scaled back, did The Visit, and it was good. Like, yeah. You know, so... I hope that trend continues. I mean, I think he's going to get a little more clout now that Split is out and is a huge hit. Yeah. And I think Unbreakable 3 or 2 or whatever this fucking ends up being will have to have a much larger budget than $9 million. But even then, like, Unbreakable is mostly just people talking. Like, it's
right.
So who knows? Who knows what will happen? But I'm very excited to see where Shyamalan goes from here. And I think that about wraps up our discussion of Split, Mike. Where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Filmbookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Cree Show. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you are emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks when, yeah, we're thinking he's back. It's it's John Wick Chapter 2, motherfuckers.
Oh man,
I'm excited about that, Mike.
Yeah, the glimmer of hope in our garbage fire of a world.
Yep. That is exactly what John Wick Chapter 2 is going to deliver. And check out our next Complete Works, where we're going to be talking Nicolas Cage's role in Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead. Mike, I don't know if you heard about this. The Alamo Drafthouse in Austin held a Nicolas Cage marathon this past weekend.
Yes, I did hear about this.
And Nicolas Cage himself actually showed up, programmed the marathon, too. He picked all the movies that were playing.
Really?
But he showed up unannounced. Like, they didn't say he was going to be there. And he just showed up without any introduction, came up to the front. People went nuts. And then he just read the entirety of The Telltale Heart for...
And then one of my favorite Poe stories. What a man. What a hero.
Yeah, so that is awesome. And one of the movies that he actually selected was Bringing Out the Dead, which we're going to be talking about. So new relevance for the Cage podcast. So thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.